I just live about a block and a half from Chapel Hill Cemetery, and I thought, I'm going to carry the flag today, Veterans Day.
90-year-old Vietnam veteran Harold Keller in Centennial.
I put on my fatigue jacket and my Army helmet. I still got my steel pot Army helmet, and I could not believe the cars went by and honked their horn and waved. I get tears when people do that.
You're listening to 91.5 KUNC.
11-year-old Sam has a guitar that is small and bright blue.
All right, it's coming along nicely. Do you remember?
She got the instrument for her birthday. When she plays it,
I feel happy.
Why?
Because like the music is like calm.
Sam sits facing her teacher Adam Petty in a practice room in Steamboat Springs.
Third fret, first fret.
They move on from chords to the classics. This is social prescribing, a non-medical approach to well-being that connects people to local activities, from nature walks to guitar lessons.
So that part, we'll play the same thing.
In Sam's case, her dad, Mike, says they saw a flyer in her pediatrician's office for a program called Prescription for the Arts.
And so we went on and called them and told them about Sam.
She had been introduced to the guitar at school and really wanted to learn. Plus, Sam has some learning differences.
What this is doing is kind of tapping into the other side of her brain, the creative side, and giving her, you know, a focus.
Colleges, hospitals, and arts organizations are putting resources into social prescribing, hoping to improve well-being for all sorts of people, from veterans to seniors. In Steamboat Springs, the Prescription for the Arts initiative aims to address youth mental health by connecting kids with art. The original idea started with local clinicians and pediatricians asking this kind of question.
Would you be interested in using arts as a way to cope with how you're feeling right now instead of or in addition to a pill?
Then they would get a prescription for an art experience, explains Danny McKinley. She's the head of Undiscovered Earth, the nonprofit that launched Prescription for the Arts in October. For now, classes are paid for through donations. A mental health clinician or counselor is usually involved.
So that there is some check-in on the progress. Is this helping? Is this not helping? And we're able to measure those results.
A growing body of research suggests there are benefits of social prescribing. At the University of Colorado Anschutz, Dr. Mark Moss has been studying
the deer out here. They're so cute, but at the same time, like, I can't have a garden, I can't plant certain things.
West Fort Collins resident Melanie Gaylord.
They'll just walk into the house if you leave the door open. I've had to start remembering to close the door, or they'll just like walk inside, like, hey, what's up?
You're listening to 91.5 KUNC.
And of course our dog doesn't care. She's like, hi, large dog. What you doing? Do you want to lay on the couch?
As Northwest Colorado loses coal jobs and dollars, a small group is raising the possibility of nuclear waste storage as a replacement. In the second installment of our series, Toxic Waste or Economic Fuel, KUNC's Scott Franz travels to coal country, an area west of Steamboat Springs where he finds mixed feelings about the region's economic future.
The ranching community of Hayden has been approached twice in the past by groups trying to sell them casinos to solve their financial challenges. Now residents are hearing about another big idea, importing toxic nuclear waste and creating the nation's first centralized storage site somewhere in the state's northwest corner. At this point, the project is an idea floating around political circles, but it's raising eyebrows at the Wild Goose, a cozy coffee shop in the center of town. I meet the Delaneys at a small table in the back.
Obviously a lot of concerns with transporting nuclear waste by rail.
Especially when we're in, to me, one of the more exciting discussions is commuter rail in our valley.
Especially if you're going to have passenger rail on the same lines. I mean, that's a big issue. But I guess I don't know enough about it.
Patrick and Tammy Delaney run this popular spot inside an old grain elevator, the tallest structure in Hayden. Train tracks run just outside this coffee shop, We don't know if these tracks would be used to import nuclear waste, and the facility wouldn't be in their town. Still, the Delaneys are worried.
What is the economic, you know, value of that? I have no idea.
Nobody has been able to pinpoint that number yet. Like other towns in the area, Hayden is losing lots of coal jobs. Tammy says the waste idea doesn't fit with her town's core values.
To me, it's clean air, clean water, communities that know each other, that we know how to grow and raise our own food, and we know how to process it, and we know how to create amazing baked goods with.
Using federal dollars, county-level conversations about a possible nuclear storage facility were happening throughout the fall. Hayden's leaders here in Rout County haven't been at the table. They actually quit the group that's floating the idea about 4 years ago.
There is no political will in Rout County for a nuclear storage facility.
Tim Redmond represents Hayden as a county commissioner. He points to facilities like this one, the town's vibrant community center, as one of many signs the town can weather the coal transition without doing something like importing toxic waste. He says major train crashes are another reason to pass on the idea.
I mean, we see what can happen with a crude oil train. My God, what are we going to do with a nuclear waste accident?
Redmond points to new developments, like a business park going up at the regional airport, as signs Hayden is doing just fine.
If I look around at all the communities that are going through this transition, I think Hayden's doing the best.
But Hayden can afford to be more selective about its economic future than its neighbors eyeing nuclear waste. Here in Rout County, there's a strong tourism industry and diverse economy centered in Steamboat Springs. Coal jobs are responsible for less than 15% of its economic output. But over in neighboring Moffat County, that number was almost 50% when the mines started closing. So there's a real sense of urgency here, as Sasha Nelson drives me around the outskirts of a small city called Craig. We're checking out a whirlwind of projects designed to help it survive the energy transition.
We're trying to do so much so fast.
Nelson is an economic.
Russ Scholl is the kind of guy who clearly loves his job. He's been on skis for 7 decades and teaching lessons at Breckenridge for 10.
Geez, I started skiing in 1959, so you do the math, haven't missed a season since.
Scholl is a friendly guy, a sort of goofy uncle type. His big, bushy white mustache picks up icicles throughout the day on the mountain.
All right, so one of my better jokes, I think. Talking hamburger, okay?
Yeah.
So how did the hamburger introduce his new girlfriend? He simply said, meet Patty.
We're riding the lift up Peak 7 at Breckenridge. Scholl tells me when he's not hamming it up, he takes one thing very seriously.
When I started teaching skiing, I carried a notebook with me. And over time, when I heard an unusual slang word for the snow conditions we ski and ride in, I would jot it down in my notebook.
But then when the mountains were shut down during the pandemic and Scholl was just sitting around at home thinking about all those slang terms in his notebook,
I thought, you know, I'll put it in a table for the table, a table, the periodic table of elements, just out of the blue.
That periodic table contains more than 130 different terms for snow he's heard over the decades. And throughout the day, Scholl drops a few of them.
I love the term cold smoke, diamond dust, mashed potatoes is a great one. Okay, so this is chokeable snow. Now I understand it fully. So it's dust on crust. So there's everything from eastern firm to almost powder. But I do have yellow snow on the chart. Don't make this snow. Don't eat this snow. Don't go anywhere near this snow.
When you spend this much time on snow, it makes sense that you'd start to develop a little nuance.
Snow is a very flexible, plastic kind of a material that changes based on many different things, from wind to temperature, sun, to people sliding across it.
Once we get to the top of the lift, it's time to see how that constantly changing material feels and sounds under our feet.
This lower section has some wonderful snow conditions on the left side. My hearing is diminished. as I've gotten older. But I can still hear pretty clearly and notice differences in skiing. The feedback I get from the sound of my skis over the surface of the snow.
At the bottom of the run, we ride the lift back up one of the highest elevation ski resorts in the country.
We're gonna get up above tree line and see what we find.
Sounds cold.
It could be.
Let's hit it.
Let's go. It's gotta be cold as it is here in the Alpine, at the top of Peak 6. And you put enough pressure on it, and lo and behold, the snow squeaks. I like that, squeaky snow. Or as some New Englanders call it, screaming lobster. How's that?
With a few more turns and a detour through the trees, we squeak and slide our way back down to the lift. I ask him, why do this? Scholl says, curiosity.
Former KUNC contributor Tom Throgmorton passed away Thursday in Fort Collins. Tom shared gardening advice on this station for almost two decades. KUNC's Emma Vandenide has more on his life and his love of plants.
It's hard to discuss gardening in northern Colorado without Throgmorton coming up. He worked at the Fort Collins Nursery, the Cheyenne Botanic Gardens, and he ran his own plant management business for more than 20 years. He also was a member of the Colorado Nursery and Greenhouse Association. From beekeeping to composting to peaches, Throgmorton had advice.
Early and mid-season varieties are the best fresh eaten. I can attest to that after slurping down a Blake freshly harvested at the orchard.
He'd record tips and tricks on his tape recorder in his basement, telling listeners how to properly care for plants in Colorado's ever-changing climate. Family members said what Throgmorton loved more than gardening itself was sharing his wisdom with the community.
Remember this cold snap. It may be why normally hardy plants are struggling next spring. Or they may not skip a beat. That's what keeps gardening interesting. For KUNC, I'm Tom Throgmorton.
Throgmorton was 68 years old. Emma Vandenide, KUNC.
Housing costs in Colorado's mountain resort towns are so high that many workers can't afford an apartment or a room in the towns where they do their jobs. In Summit County, dozens of workers opt for an unusual solution. They pay $75 a month for a pass that lets them sleep in their car in a parking lot in Frisco. The organization Unsheltered in Summit runs the Summit Safe Parking Program. The program manages the parking lot and provides a portable toilet and trash disposal. Tenants in the lot must show a pay stub that proves they work in the area. The New York Times has reported it's the only program of its kind in the country. Paul Minhades lives in one of these lots and helps manage it as a paid employee. He joined me to talk about what it's like and how he first heard about the lot after he'd lost his apartment and started sleeping in his car.
So I had been parking in a spot that was kind of hidden and incognito. And then I'd been there for maybe about 65 days where I was able to get away with it. But then they finally spotted me. So the officer came to my window and knocked on it and then said they've had this problem many times where they have to go knock on people's doors who are sleeping in their cars because it's illegal.
Right.
And then he handed me a card, like a business card, that was for Unsheltered. It was the Safe Parking Program.
Huh.
And it had a number on there for me to call. So that was my first introduction into the program or even knowing about it.
Now, you worked as a musician and you worked at Breckenridge Brewery at the time. How hard was it to try to find more traditional housing?
So by that point, I'd been living in the county for 10 years and I had been slowly shoveled around because Airbnb started taking over and then people started realizing they could do short-term housing rentals, which would probably pay them quadruple of what they would for people who are just renting, you know, long-term lease. So by that time, it had just become so hard because, like I said, everyone was starting to charge double rent or they were just flat out telling us you couldn't rent anymore after your lease because they were going to do renovations and do the short-term housing.
Mm. So, Paul, you were the first employee hired as a lot host for this parking lot about 2.5 years ago. It's a job
that sounds really similar to a campground host. Now you screen applicants who want to live there. What do you consider during the screening process?
Well, I just have to consider first if their car is actually going to fit into a normal size parking spot. So we do have people who apply that have like 35-foot campers or trailers, and then we just can't have those because they don't fit in conventional spots. I go from there, and then I ask them, you know, like how long they've been in the county, where they work, and then I just kind of ask them like their intentions, how long they think they're going to be using the program. You know, maybe what are the signs of people that, you know, aren't qualified for this program or who won't be safe for the program? Just kind of keep an eye out.
How many applicants did you have for this past winter season, and how many spots were available?
We have a total of like 33 that we used this past winter. And then after I filled up all those spots, then we had, it was between 40 and 50 people on our wait list.
Wow. High demand.
Yeah, very high demand.
Tell me a bit about what it's like to live in the lot. How hard is it to, you know, have to come back to your car at the end of a long day of work?
It's not hard at all. It's very easy and it's very comforting knowing that you have a place to go every night. And that's what I've talked with all the members. Like, they've told me, like, you don't know how much this means to me. I'm not going to be woken up by cops. I'm not going to have to, you know, be secretive. So it's just worked out for everyone's like mental health just to not have that stress.
It sounds like the safety and the sort of peace of mind of having that dedicated spot is really helpful.
Peace of mind is the key word, yes.
So there was a recent New York Times article that I mentioned that described one tenant in the lot trying to stay warm overnight in her van using an electric blanket. I'm wondering, how do people use gadgets and set up their cars to make the winter more bearable?
So she was kind of more on the low end of what people do to stay warm in their vehicle. Mm-hmm. A couple of people I've known to have 0-degree sleeping bags. So with that stuff, they can, you know, turn their car on, blast the heater, and then turn it off, and then they will stay really warm in their sleeping bag all night. Mm-hmm. That one girl, Megan, with an electric blanket that I gave her, you could put that under your blankets, and that will keep your whole entire body warm all night. And then other people that are in, like, the Sprinter vans or, like, my setup, we all have diesel heaters that just require a 3-gallon gas tank. And then that's how we stay safe and warm, because it's just like having a normal heating system inside your house.
Other towns around Colorado and elsewhere in the nation have attempted similar programs to this, but they've been shut down. Why has this program been successful where others have not?
Well, like, our main selling point to like the towns and everywhere else where we've set up, we say all of our members are, you know, full-time employed and they work in the county. So mm-hmm. I think that's where maybe a lot of people have failed to screen people, is whether or not they have a job.
And it just makes me think that there are people.
More veterans are getting their health care outside the VA and through the private sector. That's a change. The VA now says private sector referrals expand access. But as KUNC's Kyle McKinnon reports, veterans and advocates fear they're undermining the specialized care the agency traditionally provides.
95-year-old Bernie Rogoff is a Korean War-era Army veteran who spent his life advocating for fellow service members.
That's my graduating class. I'm the guy in the back, right in the middle in the back with the V8 with the Air Force hat on.
Rogoff led the push for Denver's modern VA Medical Center. It opened in 2018 to serve Colorado's nearly 400,000 veterans with specialized care. But the VA is changing things. Under the Trump administration, the agency is sending more veterans outside the VA to private doctors and clinics to get them seen faster and closer to home through a program called community care. For Rogoff, though, something special that goes beyond healthcare is at risk.
We have veterans who go to the VA and sit in the atrium just to be among their buddies. Can you imagine what they must feel? It hurts. It hurts me.
VA officials push back on those concerns. Amanda Villa is with VA Eastern Colorado. She says community care is an extension of VA services, not a replacement, especially in a state where many veterans live far from a VA facility.
We have a lot of veterans that are living in rural communities down from Alamosa all the way up to Burlington, Lamar area.
Villa says it's another way to reach veterans who might otherwise go without care.
I don't necessarily see a trend that we're going to completely go out to the community. I think we're always going to have a need for VA care, and we're always going to have a need for community care to be our extender.
That's not how Suzanne Gordon sees it. She's the co-founder of the Veterans Healthcare Policy Institute and says in many parts of Colorado, there aren't enough community providers for veterans to use.
You have 64 counties in Colorado, 53 have shortages of primary care providers.
Gordon adds that Colorado has triple the national average of patients to primary care providers.
In the late 1960s, a new show hit television screens and became a childhood favorite.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine?
Mr. Rogers modeled what it looked like to meet with our neighbors and cherish them. But we've grown more distant and private since then. KUNC's Emma Vandenhende met with one organization in Boulder County that's looking to bring these connections back to the front porch.
Ravi Rothenberg stands outside the door of a home in North Boulder. He is excited, but a little nervous. He's practicing how to invite a stranger to a community event.
Hey, sir, I'm one of your neighbors.
Are you with the city?
No, great question. No, I'm just a guy looking to create especially a place for my kids to grow up and know some of their neighbors.
Knocking on doors is one of the ways Rothenberg will reach people through the Neighborhood Village Project. It's a 10-week program designed to help neighbors to get to know each other. Rothenberg joined the program because he missed the kind of neighborhood he grew up in.
We had snowball fights and made up games and could go up to a friend's house and ring their doorbell and just ask if, you know, somebody was home and wanted to play.
The Neighborhood Village Project wants to bring back that type of community. The group meets weekly and gets step-by-step guidance, like how to make engaging flyers or how to invite people with care. This isn't a new concept. But Savannah Kruger, the program's founder, says accountability matters. Intention is only as good as the action behind it.
Life is busy. There's so much going on. I say I want neighborhood community, but I actually need to, like, do a specific set of things over a span of time and stay committed.
Since Kruger started the program last summer, around 130 people have participated from all over the state and the globe. And she's seen success.
Faced with classrooms of distracted teens, many Colorado schools adopted new rules this year. Cell phones must be put away or they're taken away. As the school year comes to a close, KUNC's Lee Patterson reports on the impact of these phone bans.
It's lunchtime at Centaurus High School in Boulder County.
It's loud again. You know, it used to be quiet and people were on their devices.
In the cafeteria, social studies teacher Jeff Jackson explains that now students actually talk to each other while they eat.
And there's still some on their computers and they're doing work or they're maybe watching highlights from the Nuggets game or something, but they're doing it together.
In January, a new district-wide policy took effect. In high schools, no phones are allowed in class, passing periods, and lunch. Senior Wyatt Chapman thought that putting phones away in class made a lot of sense. But for the whole day?
I thought, like, well, what am I going to do? Like, how am I going to coordinate with my friends for lunch and stuff like that?
But now that phones must be put away, he and his friends have set a meeting place for lunch.
With the off periods and stuff like that, like, first of all, I've done more homework. And also just there are other ways to keep yourself entertained.
In the hallways, a few students lean over their phones, hiding while they scroll. But most don't. In total, staff like Jeff Jackson confiscate fewer than 20 phones a day.
It's not perfect, but this is so much better than where we've been.
Faced with a deluge of screens, watches, and earbuds, school districts across Colorado are updating their policies to ban phones for all or part of the school day. Administrators cite bullying, mental health, and distraction as major issues they needed to address. 1 year in, schools are saying, so far, so good.
And in past years, you could see they would hurry through the test so that when the test was over, they could get their phone.
Kirsten McCreary is a history teacher at Summit High School in Breckenridge.
Now students are taking 2 to 3 times as long, same type of questions, but instead of one-word answers, they're full sentences. It's been amazing.
State data shows a majority of teens spend at least 3 hours a day on screens for something other than schoolwork. National reports suggest that around 1/3 use social media almost constantly.
Ring, 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 like, gotta check it, what's going on, someone's texting me right now.
When Summit School District banned phones this school year, students like Jada Leeks described relief. But losing access has come with downsides. Having trouble coordinating with work, for example.
Which actually happened to me once. I was trying to get an application through to a job, and I missed so many calls.
Other students describe missing texts about after-school sports.
I just think that there's like a lot of...
Dick's Sporting Goods Park was at capacity Thursday to watch Team USA defeat Ireland 4-0. Ashley Wallace drove up from Westminster with her husband and 2 daughters, Aspen and Ashley.
It's an exciting time and excited for the women and these young girls who get to be a part of it and see.
Crowds waited to meet and greet pro players, including hometown hero Lindsey Horan. Team USA's match came as Denver is developing its own National Women's Soccer League franchise. Denver team president Jen Millett was in attendance. She said Colorado is a great market.
There are so many fans that are supporters of the U.S. Women's National Team that have come up to all of us, you know, and just said we cannot wait for Denver to finally have not just a professional women's team, but a professional soccer team.
The team will play their first games in 2026 at a temporary stadium in Centennial. Mike Lyle, KUNC.
Recent White House decisions about beef imports are having on-the-ground impacts here in Colorado. KUNC's Lucas Brady Woods reports the state's cattle ranchers say the administration's policies are causing uncertainty that's bad for business.
Turnkey Cattle Company is nestled in Colorado's northeastern plains just outside of Greeley. The ranch raises calves for local all-natural beef. It's a family business, and owner Chad Sanger often works alongside his sons.
The Western way of life is, it's solid. It's family. It's all about community. And I just think that's what majority of this country is lacking.
But Sanger says it's increasingly tough for small operations like his to grow and thrive. He says cattle and land are getting harder for ranchers to afford, especially when they're competing with big corporate producers and foreign imports.
There is no incentive to stay in this industry or start in this industry because you can't buy the ground. If you buy the ground, it won't pencil.
Sanger and other Colorado ranchers say the federal government is making it harder for them to balance their books. They say decisions from the White House are creating uncertainty for American beef producers and undermining their businesses. Sanger supports President Trump and many of the administration's policies. But he was frustrated by the president's announcement in October that the U.S. would be quadrupling the amount of beef it imports from Argentina.
Why the producers and ranchers were so upset about that is you're going to say that on national television on the one payday that ranchers get a year. That's it.
Erin Spohr is executive vice president of the Colorado Cattlemen's Association. She says the decision to buy more Argentinian beef was particularly damaging because, as Sanger says, the announcement came during the one time of year when local ranchers sell their cattle.
For these ranchers, they take their calf crop to market and they get one check for the entire year. And so I think when these market disruptions happen during this time where all these calves are going to market, it really affects those producers on the ground.
In a statement, the White House says expanding imports from Argentina is intended to lower beef prices for consumers. Last month, the Trump administration also announced a reversal of beef tariffs that it had imposed earlier in the year. But Spohr says that change came too late in the season to have a positive impact for ranchers anytime soon.
There's a whole fluctuation of prices that have happened since these comments.
Well, lastly, Andy, I know you want to warn the public about how aggressive moose are, especially mothers with calves. So people should definitely be careful not to disturb a moose, keep your dogs on leashes. And on that note, we want to make sure people can identify the sound of a moose. So I can't let you go today without asking you to do your best moose call.
Well, like you said earlier, everybody loves moose. And so I got a chuckle when that was the topic you wanted to talk about. But yeah. I want to make sure that people don't let that fool you. Yeah. They're the most dangerous animal in Colorado, especially in May and June when calves are born. Cow moose will aggressively defend their calves. Stay back and keep your dogs on a leash. They're no joke. They're very dangerous and aggressive.
So is it helpful to hear what they sound like?
I can give it a shot here.
Okay.
So a lonely bull in the rut sounds like this.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And an interested cow sounds like this. So there you have it.
I feel like I'm there watching right now. Thank you. Amazing. Andy Holland is Colorado's Parks and Wildlife Big Game Manager. He talked with me about the 3,500 moose that live in Colorado. We'll include some links to more info about moose in our show notes and at KUNC.org.
We'll see if it starts.
In a huge work shed near Ray, Colorado, Rodney Lenz sits atop a nearly 7 feet tall cherry red Farmall M tractor with the beet digger. He bought the tractor and then rebuilt the digger in 2009 using a patchwork of parts and some expert advice.
I says, Dad, I see this old beet digger near Fort Morgan. So we went out and asked this guy if we could go rummage through his junk pile.
Rod sees the machine as an homage to his farming roots.
Because my first recollection of farming, really, was in kindergarten.
It was 1960, and Rod's dad, George, worked on farms around Weld County. It was beet season, and one afternoon, George planned to install a one-row digger on his M tractor. Rod couldn't wait to lend a hand.
I got out of school. I ran home probably 15 blocks. We lived right on the edge of town and was out there helping my dad put on that beet digger. Oh, man.
Now, over six decades later, he lives on his family's farmland on Colorado's Eastern Plains. This beet digger is a reminder of his love for farming, family, and a rural way of life, a life that almost didn't happen. I'm Stephanie Daniel, and this is The Colorado Dream, Growing a Future. Family farms have been disappearing across the country for decades, from extreme weather to fluctuating crop prices to water scarcity. Building a business off the land is hard. But row by row, harvest after harvest, one Eastern Colorado family is bucking that trend. This is their story. Episode 1, Rod. It's a sunny morning in May, and Rod and I are cruising around in his gray metallic Ford pickup truck. The 70-year-old is giving me a tour of the sprawling 12,000-acre Lenz Farms.
Stephanie, I want to stop here. This is, for us, iconic. This field to the left, which is not a very pretty field, I mean, it's rough, it's not the greatest soil, anything. This is the field my dad was able to purchase in 1973.
This field of sandy soil prairie land was the start of Lenz Farms. Many decades ago, Rod's parents, George and Betty Lenz, lived in Gilcrest, a small town in Weld County where they raised 8 children, 5 boys and 3 girls.
My mom was born to be a farmer, and she was a country girl, and she got married to Dad, and he worked on the railroad, and she wanted to get back to the farm so bad. So he went and took a hired man's job up in the Gilcrest and Windsor area and graduated from a hired man to a tenant farmer. Then he got to be where he was a renter, where he would actually be the farmer.
George and Betty dreamed of owning their own farm. They'd heard deep wells were springing up across the eastern plains, allowing farmers to irrigate their crops and raise livestock. In the summer of 1973, they purchased land here in Yuma County. Rod had just graduated from high school and remembers their first drive out here.
It was only 3 hours, but that seemed like forever at that time, and went to the worst piece of ground I could ever find and said, yep, this is ours. And I thought, what are you gonna do with that?
The oldest son, Mike, moved here first and started planting corn. The next year, his parents, another adult brother, and youngest siblings joined him. By 1976, Rod had a decision to make: stay at Colorado State University with his high school sweetheart, or drop out and join the new family business.
And my dad says, I'm forming a farm, going to call it Lens Farms, you in or out? That was an easy decision, you know, marry my girl and let's go home and farm. I don't need no degree. I was born to be a farmer.
Lens Farms was officially in business. Their fields are dry grasslands, but thanks to deep well drilling and the underground reservoir of water it taps into, the land was transformed. This was an agricultural game changer.
We are in the Archives and Special Collections Department at Colorado State University's Morgan Library.
That's Colorado Water History Archivist Patty Reddick.
Ever since settlers have been arriving in Colorado, the land that we now call Colorado, to set up communities and establish ways of life, they have been struggling against the scarcity, the aridity of the environment that's natural here.
Government incentives encouraged people to move to the eastern plains, she says. But at first, they farmed using rainfall and groundwater from hand-dug wells.
But of course, they could tell that if there was more water that they could use, they could grow more crops and make more money as farmers.
By the early 1900s, the technology to dig deep wells and pump groundwater really began to develop, she says. Around mid-century, a Nebraska farmer named Frank Zybach invented center pivot irrigation. It's the sprinkler system with a long pipe supported by mobile towers that rotates around in a circle. These circular patches of land, also called pivots, are what you can see from a plane.
Overall, it was a labor-saving device that could really get this water out of the ground, put it on the fields, and really revolutionized the amount that could be grown, how it could be grown.
Here, and throughout the Great Plains, center pivot irrigation systems pump water from the Ogallala Aquifer. The aquifer is a giant underground basin of fresh water that on average sits about 100 to 300 feet below the surface. It's millions of years old and extends beneath Colorado and eight other states, from South Dakota to Texas. The aquifer is a big deal. It supports nearly 30% of America's irrigated crop operations, along with significant cattle, dairy, and hog production. But this water won't last forever, as farmers pump it out faster than can be replenished from precipitation. Lynn's Farms has relied on the Ogallala since the beginning, when their operation was only a dad and four sons working the land together, just like families had been doing for decades.
100 years ago, the country was still very much rural, and so most families had a farming connection.
Tom Vilsack is the former governor of Iowa, who served as the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture under Presidents Obama and Biden. He's teaching a course at CSU this fall on how to help small farms survive and thrive.
Over the course of time, through a variety of farm policy decisions we've made, the focus has been on creating farming operations and ranching operations that can be highly efficient and highly productive.
In the early 1970s, there was an agricultural boom, and the U.S. signed a multi-year grain deal with the Soviet Union. This demand nearly tripled the price of wheat. The cost of corn, soybean, and livestock went up too. Land values increased and banks lent more money.
And our government made a specific set of decisions that essentially encouraged farmers to, as they used to say, plant fence row to fence row, really focus on productivity. Since we adopted that policy, some concerns were expressed about the impact it would have.
A big concern was that more production meant farming operations needed to get bigger. And to get bigger, they needed more money, resources, land, and equipment. A lot of small farms wouldn't be able to keep up. Then the 80s farm crisis hit. The U.S. imposed a grain embargo against the Soviet Union. Interest rates skyrocketed, while crop prices and land values dropped. There were widespread farm foreclosures and a massive recession. Since the early 80s, around 600,000 farms have disappeared.
It would take all the farmers in North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, Colorado, Oklahoma, and Missouri to equal the number of farmers and farm operations that we've lost.
As these farms vanish, the U.S. has lost over 150 million acres of farmland. But that hasn't stopped us from being one of the top ag producers in the world. What happened in the 70s and 80s touched every corner of America, including Colorado's Eastern Plains, where Rod, his dad, and brothers were just starting out. So how did Lynn's farm survive?
So I geek out over sheep more than most. I'd come back out from the office and go, I found us a couple sheep.
Wool farmer and sheep enthusiast Larae Moon of Craig.
And a couple more.
And her husband, Lewis.
I was getting in a little bit of trouble because I kept buying sheep. So I'm in a Sheep Buyers Anonymous program. I have a chip for 365 days.
You're listening to KUNC.
Yeah, that's my story because I got told I couldn't buy no more sheep.